Hello, everybody. This is the LIBF Trade Podcast, and I'm very excited about today. We're speaking to Mark Levinson. Now, Mark Levinson is an author, a historian, an economist. I came across him when I reviewed his book recently, Outside the Box, How Globalization Changed from Moving Stuff to Spreading Ideas. And I did a review of that book, which we will talk about in a second. And then I was bold enough, got in touch with him, and I'm honored to say he's accepted the invitation to be on our podcast. So hello, Mark.
Hello, Alex. Great to be with you.
And you're sitting today in Washington, D.C., is that right?
I am indeed.
Yeah, but with technology as it is, it's like you're in the same room. I must confess, I don't know if I mentioned it in our email contact, I am not renowned for being a prolific reader. And which is much shame to my father, who is a former English teacher and is a very well-read man. So I was quite pleased when I actually showed him a book that I'd read cover to cover, not only because I was reviewing it, because I actually wanted to. I know it sounds a bit weird because you're here, but it was a fascinating subject. And maybe it sort of links into the fact that it's so trade-related. I'm deemed to be a trade specialist, having worked overseas for many years in trade departments for HSBC, Santander. And the things that you were talking about in your book are fascinating. And to me, your timing is rather immaculate in terms of how it relates to the things about the supply chain. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about a bit today, if you don't mind. Maybe you could give a quick, is it possible to give a quick sort of overview of what your book covers for the listeners so that, and then we can relate to more of the up-to-date events that have been happening?
Sure. I really appreciate your comments, Alex, because I very much tried to make this a short and accessible book. Outside the Box is conceived of as a history of globalization and to look at where globalization is headed. But it's not meant to be an academic book by any stretch. This era of these long and complex supply chains that now everybody's very aware of as really the third stage of globalization. And one that's really quite different than what came before. Obviously, we had the start of globalization, I argue, starting around 1830, roughly, with the rise of industrial capitalism and a huge increase in international trade and finance. But that trade was overwhelmingly in commodities, not in manufactured goods. And that phase of globalization was extremely Eurocentric. Most of the international finance ran through London. Most of the trade ran through Europe. Probably three quarters of it was either to, from, or within Europe. And so this phase of globalization really had its limits. That globalization, and I think people are pretty familiar with this, came crashing to an end at the start of World War I when all this international investment died up and international trade dried up. Globalization didn't really restart until after World War II. And here it was very much driven by governments. We went through the successive rounds of negotiation to lower tariffs, and governments hoped that greater trade would stimulate economic growth, and in fact it did. And during this period, we started to have significant petroleum trade that became a big factor in international trade for the first time. And starting in the late 1950s, trade in manufactured goods for the first time accounted for a majority of merchandise trade. That was really the first time that commodities didn't dominate international trade. This phase of globalization, though, was also very much dominated, not just by Europe, but by what we then call the North, or the core, or the developed countries. Okay, basically Europe, North America, Japan. And they exported money and manufactured goods to poorer countries. The poorer countries, the less developed countries, the South, the periphery, as they were called in various nomenclatures, they felt themselves pretty much the victims of this form of globalization. One of the ironies in the discussion about globalization and historical perspective is that if you go back to the 1950s and 1960s and early 1970s, it was the rich countries that were preaching how wonderful all this is, and the poor countries that were really against it because they felt it was exploitative. The shoe is now on the other foot. And this is really a result of the development of a third phase of globalization in the late 1980s. The second phase more or less died amid the oil crises of the 70s. And starting in the late 1980s, there was a confluence of three factors that came together. One was the very rapid growth of container ship traffic, which I've written about elsewhere in a book called The Box. The container ships made it possible to move goods very cheaply and reliably around the world in a way that hadn't been possible previously. The second was that the cost of international telecommunications collapsed during the 1980s. Suddenly it became cheap to make an international phone call, which meant that a company could manage its overseas subsidiary or its overseas supplier in a different way. It could actually talk to them more frequently, be in touch with what's going on. And then the third thing, of course, it was a computerization improved markedly and became much less expensive. And so starting in the late 1980s, companies learned to take advantage of these three changes, and they began to build these international supply chains. They began to parcel out production of each part of their production process to wherever they thought best. I think we're headed into a new era of globalization in which merchandise trade will still be important, but it's really trade in digits, in ideas, in services that's going to become dominant.
Thanks very much for that. That's fascinating. As you know, what's interesting is we'll have people listening to this podcast from all over the world and who are involved predominantly in the trade world. It's a trade finance, trade and supply chain, whether it be in operations or sales. And, you know, when I think back to when my career started in 89, a lot of our listeners will be way younger, but that was that period you're talking about, you know, so I was out in Asia and all these things were changing. I remember, you know, the phone calls when I first moved out to Asia, I could only speak to my parents, you know, and once every month, you know, it was so expensive to call, and them likewise the other way around. And so all, I hadn't really thought about the telecom side. And also, I suppose, the ability to travel, you know, the ability to go out and see your suppliers, you know, physically, that has got cheaper as well.
People may not remember how you used to manage a company like this as late as the 1980s. The way of international communication was telex.
Yeah.
And for those of your listeners who don't remember telex, telex was a teletypewriter system. Someone at an office in one country would sit at effectively a typewriter which had a machine punch, and they would type out a message which would be punched onto a tape. And then they would dial a number on the dial that was right there on their teletypewriter, run the tape through, and at the other end of the line, a typewriter would punch out the message in letters on a piece of paper in a printer. And this was a really good system for communicating basic factual information, okay? If what you wanted to communicate was bananas, 30 cents a pound, 10 tons available, telex was great for that. If you wanted to discuss complicated management issues, telex really was not a very good way of doing business. And when it became cheaper to have a phone call, then all of a sudden it was possible to be in touch with your overseas operations and suppliers in a much more intimate way.
So my first role in the management side was in Calcutta, and the most junior person there always had the thankless job. So there's one move on, I suppose, from what you're talking about, the telegraph system is, you know, with sending telex, is, you know, so we come, there'll be identity keys, and you have to do like a calculator and make sure the number was correct as your identifier. But now, of course, with like using SWIFT, which most of our listeners will be familiar with, that's all done automatically. So the leaps and bounds, but you know, people won't be aware, depending on where their career started, of some of these things in the past, you know. But what is interesting in Britain, in terms of that supply chain, is that people will have been seeing queues for people lining up. I don't know if you had that in America, but lining up to get fuel. Because that, to me, it was like, you know, that was only a few weeks ago. There was a scarce, there was an issue that there wasn't going to be enough supply. So everybody went out and stockpiled, and it caused a major problem. And that was just like it was in the 70s, the lines of people around the block. Of course, there's not much more cars. And that's a kind of supply issue. And that's where what's interesting about what your book is talking about, you know, supply chain things, is that for us trade finance people, we're now actually, people find what we do more interesting. They go, don't you work in trade and supply chain? Oh, so I hear all this stuff about supply chain. So we can actually get involved in dinner party conversations, whereas before us in the past, maybe not so much. So I think for trade people and yourself, the time has come. The timing is really interesting with a lot of the things we're talking about just now.
It's shocking to hear that logistics is fashionable.
Exactly. And so people, I mean, I get approached by people and say, oh, I hear that a container costs this thousands of pounds to get from China to the UK. And you know, that's because it's being in the news about the cost of transport has gone up. I mean, so that's something, because in your book, what's fascinating is because you link in a number of narratives through the book. And and it is, for me, as somebody who doesn't read very much, it is very accessible. And there was like proper stories. And I was even more interested because you talk about Maersk, the shipping line in Denmark. My mother's Danish. So I was linking in. But what in terms of on the shipping side, you talk about that and the rise of like the super tanker. And that is where, you know, after I read your book, it was at the same time as the Suez Canal problem recently. And I thought, it's a real shame you couldn't bring that into your book. But I thought, I bet you he's got a blog. And I went and found your blog, and there it was. You were talking about it because it was so relevant to what was going on. It linked totally into what you've been talking about, these things being essentially too big. Or have I got that right?
We had definitely a pursuit of size, no question. Really, from the earliest days of container shipping, ships had gradually gotten larger and larger. Because the shipping lines want to take advantage of economies of scale. And this is pretty much common sense. If you double the size of the ship so that it can carry twice as many containers, you don't need twice as many engines, you don't need twice as many crew members. And so it's cheaper on a per container basis. And so that this is what the ship lines had done really since the 1960s, when we first started having international container shipping. And this really got out of hand. And we went from having ships that could carry the equivalent of 4,000 full-size containers to ships that could carry 8,000 almost overnight. And now we're up to 12,000. I'm talking about 12,000 containers of the size that will fit on the back of a truck, okay? 24,000 20-foot units, as they say in shipping parlance. And the ship lines built these because there were economies of scale. It was going to be cheaper to have bigger ships so they could lower the cost of each container and still make more money. And here's an interesting case in which the ship lines are part of a complex network that handles logistics, but they looked only at what was best for them. They did not look at what would make the entire freight transport system work most efficiently. So they've got these ships that are too big to call at many ports, too big to fill on many routes. So they're really quite inflexible. You can only use them on a handful of routes. Huge money losers if there's not enough cargo. And the ship lines lost a lot of money until early last year because, frankly, they didn't have enough cargo to fill these ships. The infrastructure, such as the Suez Canal, but also many harbors and many wharves and many cranes in container terminals, have difficulty handling these. They can take a long time to unload and reload. So they really had fouled up international trade well before the pandemic came along and well before the Ever Given got stuck in the Suez Canal.
So there's an irony there because we're talking about the shipping companies maybe by inference being slightly selfish looking at their own business. But the irony is that, and am I correct, that when the container was invented, the chap who invented it actually gave away the patent as a kind of, I would say, a very noble gesture, because he was able to actually have a system that was completely international. Is that correct? Or it's one of these ones where I get my facts mixed up.
Your facts are mostly right there. I'm very careful to point out that he didn't, this is Malcolm McLean, a US trucker, and he didn't invent the container, which was an idea that had been around since the 1700s. He's the one who figured out how to take this really simple idea and make it financially viable, which it never had been. I mean, the container had never gone anywhere because nobody, you know, you shipped a container of stuff somewhere, and then what did you do with the container? And there was no system. People were just thinking of it as a way to handle a particular shipment of goods. So he really built a system around it. But now you've got a situation in which the vessels are really overwhelming the ports. The ports are having difficulty handling the quantities of cargo that they've got. The very large vessels also made traffic through the container terminals much more volatile, because fewer ships are at sea now, fewer container ships than was the case a couple of years ago. So what this means is you've got equipment in the ports that may be doing nothing today because there's no ship. And then tomorrow, a ship comes in and it's loaded with thousands of containers that need to be discharged. And all of a sudden, there's this huge pile of cargo in the port, which is too much for the hauliers and the railways to move out quickly. And so it makes the entire transportation system less reliable.
Yes. When I worked in Vancouver for HSBC, I actually had a client in the States, and they were a grain company based, well, they had offices near Chicago and also near New Orleans. And I went to visit them, and in that kind of supply chain situation, it was probably still being done. It was all these containers, this was about 6 years ago, all these containers coming from China. Predominantly, you know, one of the biggest users would have been Walmart. And then, of course, they're in, let's say, near Chicago, and they're empty, and they've got to go back to China. So what this grain company did, as opposed to previously would have had a bulk vessel and just loaded all the grain into one vessel, it actually would put a board on the end of the container and then just pump the grain into a boarded up container, and therefore could, because the rates were so cheap to get those containers back to China, they took advantage of that. And they would just ship depending on what the freight rates are. Yes. And that's where, you know, sort of see supply chains in operation taking advantage of different cost differentials. But at the moment, it seems that, you know, freight is very expensive, linked into those kind of things. Because we've seen pictures, is it better now in the States? Because I remember seeing pictures off California, like loads of vessels waiting to get in, probably because of those problems you described.
Yes, there are probably 70 or 75 ships queued outside the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles waiting to be unloaded, and also at other ports. The kind of business you're talking about is a business that's in some trouble now, because it is very much dependent on the fact that freight rates between Asia and the United States have been much higher than freight rates between the United States and Asia. So it cost very little to send a container from the US to Asia. You could fill it with soybeans. You could fill it with waste paper. Waste paper was a big US export. You could fill it with hay. And there was, in fact, a significant business in hay. Well, today, the rates on cargo moving from Asia to North America are so high that once these containers reach the US Pacific coast and are unloaded, the incentive is to send them back to China right away, rather than to send them to Montana or to Nebraska to pick up some grain or some soybeans. And so a lot of the producers in the interior of the country who used to use containers to export agricultural commodities and other things can't get them anymore. It's more profitable for the ship line to take them back to Asia empty and fill them up as quickly as they can.
And so in Vancouver, I had a number of customers in sort of the interior. They would be sending lumber. Previously, the lumber would have been going to America, but this has been after the housing crisis. So then they had a new market out in Asia, and they could take advantage of that. There was cost differentials. I wonder if that's changed now. It would be much, I'd say, much more difficult. That's very interesting. In your book and talking about the supply chains, a lot of the thing at the moment in the UK, and of course I realize that not all our listeners are in the UK, but they probably see news about the fact we have COP26 in the UK at the moment. And in fact, proudly, as I'm a Glaswegian from Glasgow, and it's actually in Glasgow, and I was there just yesterday. But fortunately, I got out before it got too crazy. It was just the build-up. But there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of good stuff, a lot of some not-so-good stuff. A lot of sound bites. We've had our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, talk about, and it's interesting, he talks about almost like the first globalization and the UK being responsible for some of that, the industrialization, linking back to that kind of stuff, which sort of started off major pollution. And climate change, probably. So I'm just wondering if you're in the States, are you seeing much about COP26, and how do you think it kind of relates to, your subject matter? Because the shipping industry, containers, there's a whole green agenda there, isn't there?
Yes, I think that in general, climate change is probably not as prominent a political issue in the United States as it has been in the UK and in some other parts of the world. But these long supply chains and their participants are very much affected by the discussion of climate change. To a certain extent, they're concerned about possible regulation. Are they going to have cleaner ships or ships that run on hydrogen rather than on petroleum fuels. But really, a lot of this is coming from the shippers. The shippers are the people who own the cargo. And particularly shippers, companies in consumer goods industries, companies who face the consumer, are under a lot of pressure to show that they're green. They're under pressure to discuss how much emissions result from their supply chains and what have they done to reduce those emissions. And so it's these companies that then put the pressure on the ship lines and on the railways to demonstrate that they are operating with lower emissions. So it's effectively pressure spreading from consumers to the companies consumers patronize, because these companies don't want to be regarded as bad actors. They don't want to be the food processor or the clothing company or whatever that is seen as the one that's polluting. And so they in turn put the pressure on the supply chain to clean up. And that really, much more than government policy, is a force that's driving a lot of the change in the supply chain.
So what, in terms of your book, and you mentioned the future. Are you looking at? Have you got a book that you're looking at in your next book in terms of what you're thinking about in the future? Because it seems to be lots of talk about with COP26, looking at the future. Well, is that something you're looking at yourself?
There are a couple of things I'm looking at here. Okay, one is in outside the box. I talk extensively about how businesses systematically misjudge the risks of these complicated supply chains. Starting really in the late 80s, early 90s, they began to move production of many types of manufactured goods to Asia. And this was done on the basis of calculating the production cost in Asia, calculating the transportation cost. And if the sum of those two costs was less than the cost of making the goods back home, they moved production to Asia. There was no adjustment for risk, particularly the risk that the goods wouldn't get delivered on time, that the supply chain wouldn't function. And now I think we're seeing the results of that mispricing. Okay, in my view, one consequence of failing to adjust for risk is that they moved production to places that they shouldn't have, that they organized their supply chains in ways that on a risk-adjusted basis probably were not efficient. Now, your listeners are in the finance business. They understand risk. That's what they do for a living, is engage in risk in various ways. But
And sorry to interrupt, but if they don't understand risk, we can also give them training to help them do that. So there you go. You see what I did there?
That's a good commercial for you. But so I think that the question of how business begins to adjust to the risk of these complex value chains, supply chains, is really an interesting issue and one I'm keeping an eye on. The other thing that I think is happening, and I also write about this in my book, is that the source of value is really changing. And so we're seeing a lot more exchange of services and ideas, even in manufactured goods. Okay, much of the value in manufactured products isn't in the molding or the milling or the stamping or the physical assembly of the product. It's really in the intellectual property that underlies the product, the design, the marketing, whatever it is. And much of the exchange that goes on in a modern company in developing these sorts of products isn't captured in our trade data. Okay, I think, again, your own listeners experience this in the finance industry. It would not be very unusual for your listeners there in the UK, for example, to work for a firm that has a back office in Poland or in India. And this back office of the firm's employees handles their expense accounts. Okay. So when they take a business trip, they send the records electronically to this back office in Warsaw or in Bangalore or wherever it may be.
Yeah.
That back office processes these and arranges a payment into the bank account in the UK. That generally is not going to register as trade. Okay. There's been no transaction.
Yeah.
There's nothing for the statisticians to capture, but yet that type of arrangement where people move ideas and people move digits within large international companies is an increasingly important part of the world economy, and it's not going away. Many research projects now for manufacturers or for retailers involve people in multiple countries collaborating. They don't really keep close tabs on which country contributed how much to this product, because it's not interesting to the company. They don't, all these people work for the same company, but yet there's all kinds of international trade embedded in these products that we don't really know about. So I think this is really coloring the way that people think about the international economy. And I think we need to really increase our understanding of the role that the movement of intangibles, of services and of ideas plays in the world economy.
Well, that's interesting, because I think I mentioned to the listeners before, I do like a bit of science fiction. And if you watch them, I like movies. And if you watch a movie where there's a certain amount of CGI work being done, you can tell which country that sort of back office, you know, sort of outsourcing has been done, because the names will either be potentially Indian or Chinese or, you know, Brazilian. There'll be hundreds of names of these people who are working on making that, the computer work to make the movie, you know, the CGI side. Whereas in the old days, a movie credit would just be a few seconds. Now it's reams of people. And often those people are sitting on computers in other parts of the world. And so that's the same example of work is being done overseas for something that is a product somewhere else.
Some of this is captured in the statistics. Much of it is not. If you just think of your day-to-day business, you pick up a phone, you've got a transaction you're working on, you pick up a phone and call someone else who works for your company in a different country and ask a question. Can you give me your thoughts about, you know, this proposed deal we're working on? That's not trade, as the trade experts understand the statistics. The government has no record of it. It has no way to count it. But yet that is definitely an international transaction. And that's really part and parcel of what's going on in the world economy. There's an important change that I want to mention in the terminology here. People talk a lot about supply chains. But currently, I tend to favor the term value chains. And the reason is that supply chains are about moving things. And the term value chains in part picks up this idea that much of what's moving in these international relationships is ideas, digits, is intangibles. They're just as much a part of these complex processes of bringing products to market as physical outputs.
I think that's something that our listeners will be very aware of, because when they're handling various transactions, it's not only the specific goods, but there's a certain amount of value around the focus, you know, sort of draw to a close, but the focus really in the UK, the worry about the whole supply chain, but also in terms of value, the value being whether Christmas is actually going to be able to happen. Is Santa going to be able to get everything to the children in time because of those value chains? Is this an issue that is in the States? Because here in the UK, there, because of this, the supply chain, the value chains, will things be able, the cost of things are getting more expensive because of the cost of shipping the goods? Have the orders been made in time? Will there be problems along the way? Is this something that, is this just a UK thing, or is this something you're seeing in the States as well?
There's starting to be some concern about it here, but there've also been many retailers who've been on the front end of this. They were aware of these incipient problems. There's a shop, a hardware store down the street from me here, which sells a variety of goods, and they had Christmas merchandise in their window in September.
Also, it makes people think, well, you may have heard about this in the press. Well, this is, you can sort this out. We've got the stuff. You can buy it now. Avoid the rush.
Exactly.
So I think a lot of people are going to be doing their shopping earlier. So for many the listeners who might be shopping like a couple of days before Christmas, I think that is not a good idea. It's there's going to be one thing that they learn and listen to is be, get out there quickly and, you know, buy the things now before it becomes a problem. But then that's what happened in the UK when about the fuel, and everybody went out and it caused a major problem. So yeah, it's a tricky one. In terms of closing, Mark, and, you know, thanks ever so much for your time. It's really an honor to have you on our podcast. Is there anything you'd like to sort of say to the people out there? We have listeners from all over the world. And anything you want to say in closing?
Alex, it's been great fun to be with you. And I very much appreciate the invitation. I think that globalization, contrary to what you may see in the paper, it isn't going away. I think this is the world that we live in. But I think it is very important to understand that it's changing form. It's going to be different in the future than we've become accustomed to since the 1980s. And I think the public in general doesn't understand this. I think there's a lot of education to do. And I think this is going to have consequences for public policy. You know, public policy is very much oriented in this realm toward dealing with goods, with particularly with manufactured goods. And I think that the increased role of services and ideas in globalization is likely to have a lot of consequences for certain types of workers, good and bad, for the effectiveness of various government programs that are meant to help certain kinds of communities. For training and other such things. So I think there are going to be a lot of effects of this shift in globalization. And I think it's important to help people become aware of it.
Thanks very much. And to our listeners out there, goodbye.